supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. I'm sure we've all heard the story of Pandora's box, how she was given a box that contained all the evils of the world and told never to open them, and of course she did. And all the evils got out. She slammed the door shut, and one evil remained in the box. Anybody remember what it was? It was hope remained in the box. So that's interesting, how hope can be evil. On the other hand, hope is necessary. We couldn't live without it. But hope really can be, like I said in the billboard, really can be a double-edged sword. Don't we have to accept the lives we have before we can move on? The bodies we have? The relationships we have? If not, hope can have us living our lives waiting for something to happen in the future. Following my accident, I was told I shouldn't have hope that I would ever walk again. I shouldn't have hope that my body would be anything less than fragile and unpredictable. They told me to give up hope that these things would happen, and I was forced then to live the life I had. With the body I had, it wasn't easy. There was a lot of grief and anger and depression, but I had no hope for that anyway. Of course, this needs to be nuanced quite a bit. So let's talk about this balancing act of hope and acceptance in our lives. We're going to be doing it with a colleague, my friend and colleague, Barbara Wingate. She is an integrative psychiatrist who practices in Doylestown and Center City. I just got corrected. Practices in Center City. And she also teaches meditation and yoga, and we're going to hear more about that also. Later on, we're going to hear from two women, both disabled, and both have an awful lot to say about hope and acceptance, and a reaction to medical breakthroughs. So we'd love to hear from you. It's going to be an open show. Anything around the broad issue of hope and acceptance, our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. So, Barbara, answer the big questions, hope and acceptance. People in our field say we can't live without hope, but I don't get why it's so important.
I think it's tremendously important, and I can't imagine what our lives would be without hope. I think it's a question of timing. Sometimes we can't have hope for certain things because they seem unrealistic, but someone else may hold that hope for us. And oftentimes in my work, I feel like I'm the one that's holding the hope for something to be discovered with that person when they have no hope. And so I'm not trying to push it on them, but I love saying to them, let me carry the hope right now in this situation. And then I see hope as a precursor. It's sometimes a precursor to acceptance, and sometimes it's a precursor to action. So it's multifaceted, and I think it's not something that can be pushed on someone, but it's something that you may help someone grow into, and it may have unexpected results when they develop it.
I'm a big fan of Jerome Gropman. He's a medical pathologist, writes for The Times. And I loved his book, The Anatomy of Hope. And he says that hope is one of our central emotions, and we all seem to know what it is, but we all seem to be at a loss to define it. So what is hope?
Hope is a sense of everything's going to be okay for me. It's closely related to acceptance, but it is great to feel hopeful about something, and it calms me down, and it often calms other people down when you say, look, you're feeling horrible right now, but I have hope that this is time limited, and I have hope. It is a lifeline.
He distinguishes between hope and optimism here. He says optimism is the attitude that things turn out for the best. He says hope is rooted in what he calls unalloyed reality. Of course, who's to define?
They're great nuances. And what I would add into that is I think someone's religious, spiritual, or philosophy of life comes into that definition of what happens is best, or being optimistic that this was, that everything will turn out all right. And I think one's own philosophy of life, one's spirituality, one's religion will have a lot to defining what that means.
How about one's genetics? I mean, we really are hardwired here, you know?
Oh, no, we're not.
Oh, the half full, half empty wiring?
I don't know that the wiring has the end say. I just came back from a wonderful conference of about 700 people attending an integrative medicine conference in San Diego. And what they were looking at was genetics and epigenetics. So yes, we do get a set of genes, but the epigenetics, all the things that surround what happens to whether that gene gets turned on powerfully or not at all, really makes a huge difference.
All right. So biology is not destiny.
No way.
But there is biology. I mean, you come in. I'm a spokesman for this because at this point in my life, I am much happier than my genetics would have me being. Both my parents were cranky. I mean, you Google cranky, you'll see my family of origin. And, you know, I'm not. So, you know, that's an argument that biology is not destiny.
No, and I've known you for many years now, and I've watched you get happier, and I've watched you get more hopeful. So I think it's interesting to watch how people grow, and you can go to the left or to the right or sort of say in the middle, but, you know.
Well, I mean, in my case, it's just that I've gotten old and I've forgotten what I'm supposed to worry about. Let's go to the phones. We've got Linda on the line. Hi, Linda.
Hi.
Hey.
Hi. I was diagnosed with HIV in 1985, and I had my daughter was under two, and you know, it was a scary time, and I just kept thinking, well, if I can make it until she's four, you know, maybe then it would be okay if she didn't have a mom. And then it was, you know, until she's seven, and then, you know, well, when she's 15, now she's 30 years old. So it just it helped me get through a difficult time and like looking at it like that.
How do you feel?
I don't know.
How do you feel about your life, Linda?
I'm blessed. I'm very happy. And right. like you were just sharing, I wasn't always this happy, and I'm much happier now than I've ever been. I have a lot of gratitude. I live present to gratitude daily. So,
it's a weird thing. If somebody had told you in 1983 you were going to have HIV and a small baby, but don't worry, you'll be happy. You would have thought they were nuts.
Yes, I would have thought they were nuts.
Yeah.
What an extraordinary story.
Go on, Barbara.
I was going to say, what an extraordinary story, because I was the consultant to the HIV clinic at University of Pennsylvania from 93 to 96 or 7. And that was a time that was still very scary, and you were at an even earlier time. And so holding out hope was phenomenally important, and yet one had to be very realistic for many people to accept where they were. So your story is just wonderful to hear.
Did you believe you would live that other 2 years? Did you have a plan?
I wanted to, and I actually, you know, looked, like, I went to support groups, and a lot of them, I felt like I was in the minority because people were not living into hope. It was more like, you know, you need to accept that this is what's going to happen. You're just going to die. So I stopped going, and I would read a lot of things that supported my beliefs. So I had the hope that I might. I wasn't sure. I just knew I wanted to be there for my daughter. You know, her father had died of AIDS in 86. Well, and so I knew it was possible, but I didn't want that for myself.
What you're illustrating here is what a lot of thoughtful people say about hope, that hope is not a wish. Hope is a wish with a plan. And even though your plan might not have been conscious, you were living your life planfully. You went out of one group. You went towards a healthier situation. So you were doing what you could to make your life healthier. So it was hope with a plan. You were accepting your diagnosis. You were accepting what it might mean. And you had a plan.
And I would like to say that I think you intuitively or knowingly did something very important. I think you visualized you being there for your daughter. And sometimes we can think things and we can talk things and they feel horrible. But to walk around with an image of, I'm going to be there the day she walks down her high school graduation, just that image can give so much power and energy. And I'm willing to bet you had a lot of positive images that you just put out there.
Linda, thanks so much for your call.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
So you just helped me with a little problem I have with that visualization thing, that most of my friends know that I've got a TED Talk coming up this Friday, and I am scared. As a matter of fact, we're doing a show next week on performance anxiety just to help calm me down. So, but the visualization thing, I mean, of course, I forgot about that. That's really helpful. Thank you. Thank you for that. And if, don't charge me unless you take Medicare. Let's, if you're just tuning in, we're talking with Dr. Barbara Wingate, an integrative psychiatrist, about this wide-ranging issue of hope, what it really is, and the issue of acceptance. Are they complementary? Are they contradictory phenomenon? When do we accept? When do we fight against? Our number is 888-477-9499. We're going to expand it to not just our bodies. We're going to expand it to our relationships and our relationship with ourselves. So give us a call, 888-477-9499. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to be speaking with Lauren DeBrucker, who also has a spinal cord injury, about her experiences with hope and acceptance. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY FM.
Supporting WHYY, the new Center for Comprehensive Venous Health at Christiana Care, providing coordinated care with access to a team of venous specialists in one convenient location. Offering a wide range of treatments for all venous diseases, including deep vein thrombosis, pulmonary embolism, and other less severe vein conditions such as spider and varicose veins. Christiana Care, partnering with you to live a healthier life. For details or an appointment, 855-473-VEIN or christianacare.org/venous health.
Does your son or daughter come home drunk or high? Would you like to learn new ways of dealing with their drug or alcohol use? The Family Training Program works with parents of children aged 12 to 25 to help them maintain control of their child's drug or alcohol problem. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More on the Family Training Program at 877-I-WORRY-2. That's 877-I-WORRY and the number 2. Or online at iamconcerned.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about hope and acceptance. I'm joined now by Lauren DeBrucker. Lauren practices law at Duane Morris. She's also living with a spinal cord injury. And Lauren, you're also on the board at Inglis Foundation, aren't you? Do we have you?
Hi, Dr. Dan.
Hey, how are you, Lauren?
Good, thank you.
You're also on the board at Inglis Foundation?
I am on the board at Inglis.
Okay.
Which serves over 1,000 people with physical disabilities in the Delaware Valley.
And they do one heck of a job. I want to ask you about, you know, your take on this business. How long have you had a spinal cord injury?
I was paralyzed in a car accident in 1991, so more than 20 years ago.
And what were you told about hope versus acceptance?
I don't know if I was really told much of anything. It was just sort of, this is your new reality. Get used to it. And that was, you know, certainly tough to swallow and tough to hear. But I think I figured out fairly quickly that the way to get through it was just to think about what was next. I was, you know, the darkest places I was in were during times when I really could not, on days when I didn't have much going on, and days when I really couldn't see the future, or even just the next step in the future.
You couldn't. Yeah, you couldn't visualize it. You didn't have a plan.
Right. I was a college student when I got hurt, and so pretty quickly I figured out, okay, I don't know what I'm going to do, but get me back to school, and I'll figure things out from there. And then I did go back to college, and then it was, well, I don't know what I'm going to do next, but let's finish this degree, and then we'll figure it out. And then I decided, well, law school might be okay. All right, let's get there, and then, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do after that, but, you know, just get to the next step and sort of figure things out as we go.
Do you still live your life that way?
I do. I still like to, you know, I wish I had the gift of seeing all the way through to the end, but I, you know, I don't exactly have the big picture, but just sort of seeing what the next step is, what the next challenge is, what the next fun thing to do would be. That sort of keeps me moving.
What gave birth to this show was a commentary piece I wrote for the Huffington Post around a new piece of research, a pretty interesting, powerful piece of research they did with a man who was a quadriplegic. And they implanted some nerves from his olfactory nerve. That's the only nerves in the body that regenerate. They implanted them in his spinal cord. And, you know, he began to have movement, sensation down below where his spinal cord was severed. And, you know, I watched videos and he was, you know, walking with, of course, with great assistance. But, you know, he was able to move his legs voluntarily. And, you know, my commentary was about hope versus acceptance. It was right on that point. And, you know, everybody started asking me, well, do you want to do that? Would you like to do that? So let me ask you that question, Lauren. Would you like to do that?
Oh, that's a question I probably would answer. I answer differently today than I probably would have 20 years ago. Right. I've been very involved in raising money for spinal cord injury research. I'm involved in the Miami Project to Cure Paralysis, has a local chapter of the Bonacani Fund. I've been involved with them for many years. I've been a supporter of the Reeve Foundation. When I started that, it was really out of the sense of, I need to fix this. I don't want to be paralyzed anymore. I want my life back. And that was sort of the initial drive to get involved in you know, I wasn't going to be a scientist, but at least I could raise money to help pay for what they're doing. Today, it's, you know, my opinion on it has really kind of evolved in that, you know, I don't know whether this research will ever make a difference for me, but I hope it makes a difference for the next people to come down this road. I don't want any family to have to go through what my family did. And even if, you know, curing paralysis, you know, it means different things to different people. For some people, it's the sort of moonshot of standing up out of a wheelchair and walking again. For other people, it's something more nuanced. It may be getting someone off of a ventilator or helping someone with really limited function live more independently. It could mean helping, you know, a young man with a spinal cord injury start a family.
So do you live with hope?
I do. I live with hope that, at least in the research context that we were talking about, I live with hope that life will someday be a little bit easier. You know, that maybe that means walking again, maybe that means being able to do more for myself and having to count on other people less. Maybe it means, you know, something now that takes a lot of time, perhaps someday takes less time or is less difficult to do. So I do live with hope, but, you know, hope for what? You know, that sort of changes on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, that really is what hope is about. You know, if you have a picture of what you hope for and you clutch too tightly for that, you're in trouble.
Well, and I think, you know, there's people who hope so hard for something that they miss out on what's in front of them or what they can do. I mean, you and I have peers in the spinal cord injury world, you know, some of whom are you know, cling so tightly to hope that they really sort of never or have a tough time sort of living their own lives as they are today. And I think, you know, my sort of philosophy is you may never get over what happened to you, but you do kind of have to get on with things, because otherwise you're at the dark place to be if you don't.
Well said. You may never get over, but you have to get on with things. Well said. And I think on that note, I'm going to say goodbye to you. I look forward to the next time we meet. Lauren, thanks so much for taking the time and sharing your experience and your wisdom, especially at the end.
Oh, thank you, Dan. It's been my pleasure.
All right. Take good care. So, Barbara Wingate, that last statement Lauren made, you may never get over it. It addresses the issue that you talk about a lot, and that's grief. So there's what Lauren said is there's no end point. There's no point where it's all done. You're all done grieving.
But it changes in intensity. And I think that's the thing. You may grieve a loss your whole life, but depending on what else is going on, and I loved what she said, people who are clinging so much to hope miss the pleasure of their current life and what it already has and what else it might include if they weren't so busy hoping. And, you know, I could put that on a personal note. I hoped for years to be a mother, and it wasn't happening. And I struggled with finding the right person, infertility. But I hoped that I'd be a mother, but at some point I accepted it and ended up with the most wonderful daughter. And so I think if I'd been clinging, I'm an adoptive mom who, I use that word, but I'm just a mom who adores her daughter the same way anyone else does. And I think if I had been clinging or grieving that it wasn't going to happen biologically, I would have missed one of the biggest gifts of my life.
Somebody said the other day about his marriage to me that he's divorced 5 years. And someone asked, did you get over it? Does the pain and sadness of this breakup, does it go away? And he says, no, it'll never go away. It's always in there. He said, you know, deaths in my life. People I've loved who have died, you know, that sadness is in there also. That's not going to go away, nor do I want it to, he said.
Well, I would go back to that word intensity again. I would hope that you might have a memory every day of my father. Am I grieving his loss? He was wonderful, yes, but it's turned more into a celebration. Oh, he would love this tree, or he would laugh at this joke. And then I move on to the pleasure that's in my life now. So I think that has to be true with divorce.
Yeah.
I think if you cling to ever for what you'd hoped it would be, rather than moving on and celebrating what it brought you or relief that it's over.
The word cling keeps coming up, doesn't it? No coincidence there. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Catherine on the line. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Dan. How are you doing?
Good. How about you?
I'm fine. I wanted to talk about the time in my life when I was being diagnosed with MS, and there were a lot of other diagnostic categories that were being considered that were even scarier than MS. And I was in a real frenzy. And I think that at the time, the hardest part was not knowing what was going on. And, you know, hoping for the best outcome, but not knowing and fighting with not knowing. And over the years, that was 11 years ago, and over the years, I found that we never know. We just don't know what's going to happen the next day or later in the day, and that's how I deal with the MS symptoms. I know they're there, and I deal with each one as they come, and I don't hope for some magnificent cure in the future because, in my mind, hope is the projection of a preferred outcome, which can only lead to suffering. You know, not only does it take us out of the present moment, but it gives us, you know, if this thing happens that I'm hoping for, then I'll be happy. If it doesn't happen, then I will suffer. But as previous guests have so eloquently stated, then we're missing what's happening right now in our lives.
So. You wouldn't describe yourself as hopeless, certainly.
As hopeless, not at all. Yeah. I'm very grounded in the moment and not looking to the next day, you know, but trying to take care of whatever it is that's needed now, not anguishing about the next day either.
I would like, Catherine, I'd like to read you and you, Barbara Wingate, a quote here. I'm going to come all the way back to Jerome Groopman and his book, The Anatomy of Hope. And, you know, he's been a pathologist for 30 years, and he's worked with patients who were quite ill and many of whom, you know, he was with as they were dying. Here's how he defined hope. He said, hope is the elevated feeling we experience when we see in the mind's eye a path to a better future. He goes on to say, hope acknowledges the significant obstacles and deep pitfalls along the path. True hope has no room for delusion. And my simple-minded interpretation of that is simply that I have hope that I can be happy tomorrow, regardless of what happens to my body. Now, I know there's a damn good chance I'm deluding myself, but that's my hope.
Well, go ahead.
It's about a sense of happiness, a sense of well-being. Isn't that what we all want, Barbara?
Well, sometimes you have to start a little, I'm going to say, more grounded or lower than be happy. I hope I have the strength to deal with what tomorrow brings. And then if I can deal with that, I can work myself back to contentment or happiness or joy in the moment, even in the midst. But oftentimes, I hope for the strength to deal with whatever gets thrown my way.
Well done. Catherine, thanks so much. Thanks so much for your call. We want to take a short break. I want to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking with Fran Fulton. She's a manager at Independent Living Services at Liberty Resources, and she just received the Argus II Bionic Eye at Wills Hospital, and we're going to hear about it. It's just an extraordinary story. We're talking about hope and acceptance today on Voices with Dr. Barbara Wingate, an integrative psychiatrist. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. That's 888-477-9499. Have you been holding out hope that your spouse would be different, or your body would be different, or your parents would be different, or your history would be different, on and on and on, or all of the above? So our number is 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
I'm Dr. Russell Kaufman, president of the Wistar Institute. Wistar proudly supports WHYY and announces the opening of its new 7-story Robert and Penny Fox Tower, designed to accelerate scientific discoveries. Here, Wistar scientists are working together to create cancer treatment vaccines. These unique vaccines direct the body's own blood cells to attack cancer cells. Learn more about this and other advances at Wistar.org. The Wistar Institute. Today's discoveries, tomorrow's cures.
Supporting WHYY, Germantown Friends School. Learning is for life. This idea is at the heart of Germantown Friends School, where the years from kindergarten through 12th grade are viewed as just one chapter in a long learning adventure. At GFS, their sense of the power and value of education defines their daily work. They teach their students that the world is theirs to experience, to understand, to create, and to change. Learn more about their K-through-life mission at an open house on Tuesday, November 11th, 8:15 to 11 a.m. Reservations at germantownfriends.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about hope versus acceptance of our lives with Dr. Barbara Wingate, integrative psychiatrist with offices here in Center City. I'm joined now by Fran Fulton. Like I said before, she just received the Argus II Bionic Eye at Wills Hospital early this year. Fran, good to hear from you again. Welcome.
Thank you, Dan. Pleased to be here.
So, what's new?
What's new? I've entered a new in my life. I'm learning new skills. They say you never stop learning. Without a doubt, I am still learning. I did, as you said, I have been blind for many, many, many years. You're talking about hope, and, yes, I have hope, and I do hope, but I don't count on it.
What did you hope for before all of this? And by the way, we should say you've got retinitis pigmentosa, and this is a genetic disease.
It's a hereditary disease. It's degenerative. It starts at the periphery, and the rods that are in your eye start to degenerate until, as a youngster, I had no night vision. I never had night vision. And then your periphery starts to go until you get down to a tunnel vision, which I did have for some time. And then it moved into the center of my eye, and all I had left at the end was very, very bare light, like a degree or two of light perception, and it was all gray. I couldn't see anything, couldn't see shadows, couldn't see outlines.
So, listen, Fran, before we get into all this psychology business, you've got to tell us about this surgery. It is mm-hmm. amazing story.
Mm-hmm.
What did they do?
Yeah. What they did was they went all the way to the back of my eye and to the retina, and that's where the damages are. And they put an electronic array and one of the bands around the retina. They went past the first band, which are the damaged cells, and went to the second band. And with this device, that array stimulates the retina cells that might be the good retina cells that might be left. And what it actually does is it creates a digital image. I do not see like I did when I was 15 years old. I don't see like people see today. I see digital images. And what that does, so I have this implant in my eye, and then I wear these Oakley sunglasses. I don't think they're very fashionable, but people tell me I look like Geordi from Star Trek, because they're kind of shaped like that. And they have on the side of them, there is an encased coil that talks wirelessly to the electrodes in my eye, the array in my eye. And then there's a little set of also encased electronics. On the bridge of the sunglasses, you can barely tell, but there's a little circle, and that is a camera. My eyes don't see. They don't see anything anymore. They haven't for a long time. But the camera sees. So the camera sees an image, and that it is sent down through the electronics to a video processing unit, a VPU, which is about the size of an iPhone, only a little thicker. Just to give you an idea, I can hold it in my hand. That video processing unit then takes that image and converts it to a digital image, sends it back up through that coil that talks wirelessly to the array in my eye. And I get these digital impulses, which I am learning to interpret. It takes a while. It doesn't just happen overnight.
There's a video of this.
You've seen it.
Oh, yeah. And my listeners are going to see it also. Can we get that on our webpage? Can you get that to us? We'll put it on our webpage.
Sure.
All right. It really is.
I will see that it gets to you.
Now, listen, I have to tell you something, Fran. I am watching here. I'm watching Barbara Wingate. I'm watching Al Banks, the engineer. I'm watching everybody in the engineer's room. Everybody's sitting there with their mouths wide open, shaking their head back and forth.
This is an absolutely phenomenal breakthrough in vision. I certainly had gone through, you talked about earlier, loss and grief. Every time there was more degeneration in my eye, I had a sense of loss, and then I was grieving, then I was lost, then I was grieving. Finally, my sight's totally gone, and it was, I hesitate to use this word, but almost a relief, because that whole process had come to an end. And I'm also, I'm a realist, and what I was hearing was, oh, 3 more years is going to be a breakthrough. 3 more years is going to, 3 to 5 years, 3 years is going to be a breakthrough. And there's a lot of work going on, stem cell research. And then I had caught wind of this bionic eye they were working on, which was, you know, something kind of interesting too. Who would think, you know? But it was in January of this past year when my older son had read that the Argus 2 was now available for commercial use.
Now, we should say both of your sons have retinitis pigmentosa.
Yes.
So what does
both have RP.
What does this mean for them?
Well, I think it means a lot. I think right now what I see digitally is black and white. Maybe at some point in time, I have a wire that connects my sunglasses to this little VPU, which I, you know, stick in my purse or in my pocket, but maybe it'll be wireless. Maybe it'll be color. Maybe, you know, there'll be a lot of, design changes that will make it, a little less, you know, visible
yeah,
doesn't bother
yeah.
me, but just, you know, out there, let's put it that way. Wouldn't make me stand out quite so much. I think it gives them hope.
Yeah.
I think it gives them hope.
It gives them hope.
and that they are not going, they will go blind. They will. You cannot get this device until you are blind or have bare light perception. And they will go blind. And I think they now know that there is something there that can bring back sun sense of sight. Like I said, it's not like it's you see or others see, but it's a true supplement to my skill sets as a blind person. I use a cane, and they tell you to continue to use your cane. And I know I will probably never be able to see the faces of my grandchildren, the details of their faces, but I can't tell you the extraordinary feeling that went through me when they stood on the grass in front of their house and I arrived and I could tell the difference between them. I could tell, you're Rebecca, because she's taller, and you're Isaac. And they just jumped up and down, and just so exciting to actually know which was which. And I can cross the street using, of course, my ear. My ear is my lifeline in doing things like that. But I can also see the white lines in the crosswalks when they're there. Not always there.
I have to tell you now that my fantasy is sitting down with you in front of everybody listening right now and talking to you for about 3 hours, because we haven't even touched the psychology of it. And and I hear it in your voice. I feel it in me. I'm watching Barbara and everybody else. We're all feeling such deep emotions, and I don't even have words for mine.
But it's absolutely phenomenal, and I'm going to tell you a secret. Okay, can you keep a secret?
All right.
I can be looking at you in my digital with my bionic eye, and your head will be blinking, and then I can close my eyes, and guess what? I can still see you because it's a bionic eye. It has. You know, we were talking again. Your theme is basically hope and acceptance. I had long ago accepted the fact that I was blind. I had no problem dealing with it. I mean, there's a lot of people that are in denial for a long, long, long time. But I always had this philosophy that, you know, I could sit back and live off government subsidy and watch soap operas and eat bonbons all day, or I could pick myself up by the bootstraps and get on with my life. And I chose the second one only because I don't like bonbons.
Yeah,
but that's besides the point.
They don't even have bonbons anymore, I don't think.
Oh, see, there you go.
Barbara,
I'm dating myself.
Barbara?
I have a question. I had someone write me and say, because I was asking friends and colleagues about this, that the opposite of hope was despair. And when you had moments of despair, as all of us have had, do you remember what helped you move on from despair back to acceptance or hope?
That's a very interesting question, because aside from my blindness, my husband passed away at a very young age. And here I am, blind mom with two sons who are also going to go blind. Talk about despair. I think a lot of what has always pulled me out of it was my family support. My parents did raise me to know that I could do anything I wanted to do as long as I put my mind to it. And my children. You know, I had them to raise, and how can I raise them? They were both dependent children at the time. And how could I raise them if I am stuck in these moments of despair? It was you know, the same kind of thing. You've just got to pull yourself up by the bootstraps and go forward. I truly believe that I can do anything, just about anything anybody else can do. Just do it differently. Except drive a car and fly an airplane. Can't do those things.
I'm going to add in there that one of the things that I take out of your answer is that love brings you out of despair. You had love from your family, and you loved your children, and that would take you out of despair.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it does. And support. You know, love and support.
Yes.
And I certainly had a lot of support from, I am not from Philadelphia, so when my husband passed away.
We could tell from your accent.
I've lived here 42 years.
I can't believe it.
But anyway, so I had no family to kind of lean on other than by telephone. And I think, you know, the support of my girlfriends, my neighbors, very, very important. And I love them, and they love me. And you're right, it's love and support.
Yep, it sure is. Fran, I just want to thank you so much for sharing your story with us, for giving us the opportunity to share your story with a larger audience. And we're all looking forward to seeing that video on our webpage.
I'll have Will's eye send it over to you.
All right. You made me a happy boy today, and I don't think I'm the only one.
I'm glad. If you want to call tomorrow, I can make you happy tomorrow, because I heard you say you hope you're happy tomorrow.
It's a deal.
All right.
All right. Take care of you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure talking with both of you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Let's address that big topic of hope versus acceptance. At what point, and I'm talking about ourselves, our lives that we have, do we accept ourselves for who we are versus pushing ourselves to change?
Are you asking me?
That's why we paid you all this money.
Oh, and I'm going to spend it all right away. I think it's both. I think you need both. I think I need to accept where I am and what's going on in my life. But I also, and I choose to use the word inspire. I like to be inspired by other people. I like to be inspired to grow. And I like to have a creative imagination that says, well, you don't know what's coming yet. And let's just sit down and get inspired or creative and imagine something new without denying what your current reality is. But I think it's a nice combination of both that gets me through the day and is the hallmark of my work with people.
You use the L word.
Big one.
Yeah, and it really is a big deal. And love does get us through things. And, you know, one of the things I realized is not just my adversity and the people who love me, but it's the people I love that get me through the adversity. And I realized that I could be that person who loves someone at the right moment in the right way to help them get through adversity. And love is not about an agenda to change. Love is just loving the person as they are. I want to read you one of my new favorite quotes here from Anthony DeMello. He's a Jesuit priest and psychotherapist who said, I was neurotic for years. I was anxious and depressed and selfish. Everyone kept telling me to change. I resented them, and I agreed with them, and I wanted to change, and I simply couldn't, no matter how hard I tried. And then one day, someone said to me, don't change, don't change, don't change. I love you as you are. I relaxed, I came alive, and suddenly I changed.
That's beautiful.
So that really addresses the issue, doesn't it?
It does.
And if we can say that to someone else, and not be cheerleaders, you know, you will get better, I know you'll get better, it won't, you know, not be cheerleaders, but hold someone, love someone for who they are and what they are, you know, then maybe we can teach them to do it for themselves.
I totally agree. And I also want to pick up on something you said. Sometimes we're waiting so much to be loved. I want this, I want that, I want to feel loved. And if you can, and I've learned this from many readings and teachings, if you can shift it, sometimes I have to catch myself and say, I need to love. I don't need to be loved. And all of a sudden, the energy shifts, and you go, in a way, from seeing the glass half empty to the glass half full. And that is, oh, I need to worry less about being loved and more about being loving and giving that to someone else.
Yet, you won't be shocked to hear that my TED Talk is about love and and whether we feel lovable. So I've looked at some of these great quotes. So John of the Cross said, where there is no love, put love, and then there will be love. It's not complicated.
That.
But to learn to love, we have to nurture that skill. Practice loving. And, you know, I wonder if you and I have a responsibility to teach that as therapists or nurture that as therapists.
We do. And to bring it up as an act of loving, teaching people to be more loving. Sometimes I'll bring it up in the terms of someone who's so miserable. I say, is there someone you can give to? Is there a project? And, you know, whether it's taking care of homeless kids or animals or older people or hospice work, if somebody can shift their energy to, because I see resourceful, wonderful people all the time. And if you can shift some of that despair into them helping someone else, all of a sudden they feel better.
That's and we're going to have to end on that note, on those marching orders that you've given. Barbara Wingate, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been great. We've been talking with Dr. Barbara Wingate, an integrative psychiatrist in Center City. Early on, we heard from Lauren DeBrucker and most recently Fran Fulton. Next week, like I said, we're going to be talking about performance anxiety. Well, you can find us at whyy.org/voices. You'll be able to see that videotape. We are at Voices in the Fam on Twitter, and I am at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Loon is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Lindsay Carfagno is our intern. Larry Roebling produces Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.